These days, most of us carry around what is essentially a high-powered computer in our pocket. Texts, email, news, social media, it's all a click away, anytime, day or night. This hour, different aspects of our 24/7 culture. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. All this week on Talk of Iowa, it's Iowa Week. We're exploring Iowa after dark. And today, our 24-hour culture. Ross's restaurant in Bettendorf was one of the first diners in Iowa to cater to a 24-hour workforce. I'll talk with Cynthia Friedhoff, whose dad founded Ross's. We'll also talk about other businesses that support that workforce, our 24-hour news cycle, and how work increasingly encroaches on our leisure time. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. All this week on Talk of Iowa, it's Iowa Week. We're exploring Iowa after dark. Tomorrow, we'll find out about hobbies and sports that thrive in the nighttime. On Thursday, we'll work the night shift. And on Friday, explore nightlife around the state. Today, it's our 24-hour culture, the 24-hour news cycle, how 24-hour work affects far more people than those who work the night shift. But first, the people who feed our 24-hour workforce. Ross's restaurant in Bettendorf was one of the first diners in Iowa to cater to a 24-hour clientele. It opened in 1939, founded by Harold Ross. Cynthia Friedhoff is here. She inherited the business from her dad. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, your dad started serving food at night even before he opened the diner. How did that get started?
Well, he just started feeding them by going out to the factories, and if they were working late at night, he would go out there and sell sandwiches and such.
All right, so he was looking for that 24-hour workforce, as the factory culture was keeping people up all night. I'm sure they were hungry. And then he opened the diner in 1939, which was well ahead of a lot of other 24-hour restaurants in Iowa. Was it one of the only, as far as you know?
I think it might have been. I think he was one of the few pioneers of the 24-hour diner.
Running a 24-hour business is extremely challenging. I know you've worked a lot of night shifts in your time. Tell me what it's like at night.
Well, it's kind of interesting because you get a totally different type of clientele that come in, and they certainly don't have as many inhibitions as other people, as most of them have been drinking, although there are certainly people that come in that have worked at night and come in for breakfast prior to going home. But it's just all sorts of different kinds of people, just like it is during the day, but maybe a little bit less inhibited.
Is it less busy at night than it is during the day?
Well, it has gotten to be that way in our new location, because a lot of people don't know that we're open even, and so that's been a real detrimental thing to our late shift. And in addition, it's not right where every city can come real readily, so that's been a little bit of a challenge. But
right,
we're
your
on
last
that.
Location was right on the highway; everyone could see you if they were driving through, right?
Exactly. Yep.
So, from working the night shift, what do you think you've learned about people?
I just learned that there's all kinds of people in the world, and they all have their story to tell. And when they, you know, when I talk with them, many times they open up and tell me their story. And so it's just you learn about all different kinds of people. And I love people all over the world. I've traveled all over the world, and I just find people very interesting, no matter what their message might be.
Do you feel like you mentioned some people's inhibitions are lower because they've been drinking, but across the board, do you feel like sometimes people are more open at night because it just has a different feeling?
I think so. I think that's very well put. Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening. And my late shift employees really enjoy it. They enjoy all the camaraderie they have with the people that come in.
Do you have any unique stories to share of things that have happened on the night shift?
Well, twice a year, Augustana College, right across the river, they bring their choir in. And they've got 50 people, about that many people come in, and they come in and they eat a something that's called a mudslide, which isn't even on our regular menu, but maybe we should put it back on. It's a waffle with it has ice cream on it and all sorts of fruits, and then they it's just a real interesting concoction. So they have mudslides. And then, and other things as well—the volcano and the Magic Mountain, and the gluten-free and the vegan—they like—they like the fact that we have such a variety. But then they, at the end, they all stand up and they sing a song for the people that are in the restaurant, and everybody just goes wild by it because there's 50 voices in there singing in our place, and so it's a really neat thing.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun tradition. Well, Cynthia, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you so much.
Cynthia Friedhoff of Ross's Restaurant in Bettendorf. Her father, Harold Ross, founded Ross's Restaurant in 1939, one of the first 24-hour diners in Iowa. And these days, a lot of restaurants, convenience stores, and stores are open 24 hours a day. That means a lot of night shift workers and a lot of people taking advantage of those services. It's a big part of the hospitality industry. Bob Bosselman is professor of apparel events and hospitality management at Iowa State University, and he is with me now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
So Ross's Restaurant was a little ahead of the curve here in Iowa, but there was a big boom in 24-hour food service after World War II. Tell me a little bit about what was driving that.
Well, during World War II, of course, the economy geared up in a very, very significant way, and 24-hour operations, and people had to eat, and so a lot of operations were developed during that time. You saw the early diners, cafes. Certainly, many of the factories would offer their workers some kind of food in some way. I don't think we would call it as fancy or equivalent to what we have today, but they wanted their workers to be nourished so that they could continue to work.
And nowadays, we really take this 24-hour access for granted, don't we, with the hospitality industry?
Indeed. It's usually going to be found where there's a significant population center or, you know, has been discussed, some kind of factory or work situation where that place is going 24 hours a day.
We've seen a lot of convenience stores really become mini restaurants in and of themselves. Again, that's a business that caters to people who are passing through a community or getting off that shift work, that kind of thing. Is that an area that we see growth in?
Well, it certainly has been an area of growth for some time. Look back years ago, those operations were gas stations, and then they would sell newspapers, gum, cigarettes, things of that nature. And, of course, slowly, more and more, they realized, well, hey, we could sell soda, we could sell pizza, we can sell a sandwich. And nowadays, you walk into these places, and it is like walking into a version of a restaurant. They've got everything you would want. So that's a very big growth area, and probably we don't see the end of that at this point.
When you're preparing students to go into the hospitality field, is talking about the night shift an important part of that preparation?
Well, you know, the hospitality field, every hotel is 24/7, as we know. So a lot of students want to work in hotels. And one of the first things we explain is recognize it's 24/7 and you're the new kid on the block there. You're probably not going to be working the day shift a lot. So you have to be prepared. They need a broad skill set. We try to explain to them it's a dynamic field, high energy. You're working with a lot of people, both with you in the operation, but you're also dealing with a lot of people, and you have to have very strong people-oriented or soft skills, as they're called.
Are we seeing any, we're going to talk a lot more about how we're plugged in 24 hours a day. Have we seen that kind of shift in our culture affect the hospitality industry as well?
Certainly the impact of the digital age is upon us. You have hotels now that don't have front desks, that your phone is your room key. So when you make your reservation, either with the hotel directly or via some other third-party intermediary, automatically your reservation becomes not only, hey, I have a room at the hotel, but my phone or my number, if you will, becomes my room key. So you simply walk into the hotel, put your phone next to your door, boom, door opens, you're in the room. That's just one example of what's going on.
That's fascinating because in a way, I can see that being a service that a lot of people would enjoy because if you're busy, if you want to just get to your room, you don't necessarily want to interact with someone. On the other hand, that's pretty impersonal service.
Indeed it is. Where we see it happening initially is in what is called the select service or limited service market. In other words, we'll call them the roadside operations along your highways, where people are the road warriors and traveling here and there. We haven't seen it yet in the larger urban properties or convention resort properties, because there people are still looking for that people-to-people contact.
When your students are thinking about the businesses that they want to be a part of, do you feel like we're seeing some pretty rapid evolution in these hospitality businesses? Are they going to be changing pretty dramatically over the next 10, 15 years?
Quite frankly, Charity, I don't think we know where things are going. I think that the changes we've all observed over the last 10 or 15 years are dramatic. And it's up to the ingenuity and the creativity of all of these young people that is going to open up a lot of new opportunities in different ways. Many of them are fascinated by the growth of delivery services. For example, Denny's is probably one of the more well-known 24-hour operations, you know, grew out of the cafe field. They now have delivery. So who would have thought something like that?
Are there changes that have really surprised you?
No, not really. I think as an educator, always open to what are the new ideas and fascinated by the new ideas. Probably the surprise is how fast technology has moved.
And do you see any changes on the immediate horizon that you think are trends we should keep an eye on?
I think the challenge moving forward, young people, they're very keen on all the technology. My concern is that they don't lose the ability to interact personally. I'm concerned that we're all walking around looking down at our phones too much, and we lose the concept of sitting down with somebody, just sharing a cup of coffee and talking about today or tomorrow, what's going on, that sort of thing. So we're trying to encourage our students to keep an open mind, be very conscious of your fellow student, others around you, be open to discussing ideas. That's how we keep moving forward.
Do you have to coach your students on that quite a bit? Do you feel like that's a skill set that maybe they're not coming to you with?
Well, you know, every class, and I think every professor would say this, they're looking out before they start the class and saying, put the phones down, please.
All right, well, Bob, stay with us. We're going to continue this conversation. Bob Bosselman is a professor of apparel, events, and hospitality management at Iowa State University. This hour, we're talking about our 24/7 culture. We're going to talk about our 24-hour news cycle and how being plugged in 24 hours a day has encroached on our leisure time as well. And you are welcome to join the conversation. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. Slap 'em up, put 'em on a train, out of Michigan up to Maine. Now, give me $5 down to Georgia, Carolina, up to 20 by the Pickwick, near the country out of Waynesboro. Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa, and all this week we are exploring Iowa after dark. This hour, we're talking about our 24-hour culture. We'll talk about the 24-hour news cycle and also how being plugged in 24 hours a day is encroaching on our leisure time as well. And of course, people who are part of news organizations have always worked the night shift to make sure that newspaper hit porches early in the morning. But the news itself used to sleep, at least a little bit. Now we've got news breaking and being reported 24 hours a day. David Dowling is associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa, and he is here with me now. Hello, David.
Hello.
Thank you for being here. And, I mean, when we do think back to that newspaper culture, there was a time when you put the news to bed and then things started happening again the next morning. When did that start changing?
Well, you know, it really did change pretty suddenly in the 1980s with something that's called the CNN effect. And that really hits with Ted Turner and the Turner Broadcast Corporation. The TNT, you know, CNN starts to form at that time in the 1980s as cable sort of comes into its heyday. And then we get 24-hour news on television. We get what's called saturation reporting of things like the 1989 fall of communism in Eastern Europe, Tiananmen Square protests, the 1991 Gulf War. So this now refers to much more than the CNN 24-hour sort of cable news process. And definitely, you know, refers to and is relevant to obviously online news, radio, et cetera. And it wasn't just cable TV that started the 24-hour news cycle. It was, to be sure, much earlier in the mid-20th century with 24-hour radio news. And a lot of people don't recognize that, but they weren't really doing the sort of saturation reporting that CNN was, say, with the Tiananmen Square coverage and things like this.
Right. Although I'm sure they were desperate to have new things to say if they were talking 24 hours a day.
Well, right? And thus they were doing what was called rip and read, which is what some of you guys do once in a while. You know, you probably shamelessly indulge in this. But rip and read simply alludes to, you know, tearing out a story out of the newspaper and just simply reading it for lack of news. This was, you know, one way that they would not have to do their own reporting.
Right.
So that's a totally different thing, though, with the CNN effect, where those reporters are going out there and aggressively covering every last square inch they can find.
Well, it's interesting. And when you think about radio in the 50s and 60s, there was definitely a relationship with the BBC World Service, which was one of the first 24-hour news networks in the world, where they really were covering things around the globe. So it strikes me that there is part of this 24-hour news cycle is our global connection, the world becoming a smaller place because of our technology making it easier to communicate.
Right. I mean, there's definitely benefits of this. You know, there's a lot of pressure on journalists. A lot of people have, you know, criticized the effect on journalism. They've said, you know, that this is really, you know, actually led to, you know, more and more competition for audience share. We have a sort of a profit demand for, you know, corporate ownership leading to a decline in journalistic standards. However, you know, with that 24-hour news cycle, we do have much more of a global kind of marketplace for news now. A lot of people will argue, though, we want more sensationalism, more entertainment, opinion. It's sort of the journalism of assertion rather than a journalism of verification and relevance, depth, and quality. Even interpretation and context, people have said, have eroded and washed away. And I would say that in the digital age, with our 24-hour news cycle and just how fast things are, this accelerated culture has shallowed out the news on one level. But I would argue, and you know, I've said a lot of this in my own research, that was especially true in the early 2000s. But I think right now, in the second decade of the 21st century, we are absolutely seeing a renaissance in long-form journalism. And we see that in podcasting, for example, the fastest-growing sector of digital publishing in the world. It's phenomenal. And people will, okay, I alluded to the CNN effect for the 24-hour news cycle, but then there's also the serial effect for radio, for audio storytelling. That's a nonfiction series by NPR that Serial represents. We also have S-Town that comes after mm-hmm. that, which has just dwarfed its numbers.
And really hyper-in-depth reporting.
Hyper-in-depth and beautiful sound design, you know, something that you all can appreciate mm-hmm. here. It's radio brought to sort of symphonic orchestral levels. That kind of depth, it really represents kind of an immersive storytelling to go along with our immersive technology like 360 and VR that's now coming in, that the New York Times has partnered with Samsung, for example. So our technological revolution now is partnering more and more these big tech companies with news organizations, and I think it's yielding wonderful long-form pieces that are indeed immersive, and we just haven't seen this. We didn't see it in the early 2000s, and if you look back to the first long-form stuff online, Mark Bowden's Black Hawk Down, 1990s, it's horrible to look at, right? It's just a mess of, you know, sort of very busy links and you know, places to go to try to find the data to, that supports his wonderful sterling prose, but it's sort of lost. The narrative is lost. So multimedia storytelling doesn't really grow up and become mature, I would argue, until the second decade now that we're in of the 21st century, and it really happens with Snowfall by the New York Times, that multimedia piece. And then thereafter, a wonderful piece called Greenland is Melting Away, which is science journalism, which I think does digital long form now better than ever. We're having a renaissance in science journalism. So I'm not one to be a Luddite and a technophobe here and say all of
it's all bad.
It's all bad, and it's all getting shallow. But I think we're getting depth, too.
It's so funny, though, because we have that pressure, that movement on one side for these in-depth pieces, the long reads. And then on the other side, we have the Twitter culture, where you want to be the first one to release a headline. So that pressure to be first, that creates a danger as far as accuracy, doesn't it?
Right. It absolutely does. And so a terrific example is that the New York Times ran a profile piece. This is long form feature story on a gentleman who is a member of the Nazi party, neo-Nazi person, just living a very normal everyday life in the Midwest. And readers protested. And they wrote in, and there was like a Twitter, you know, firestorm that came at the New York Times. And because of the speed with which and the accountability that we're holding news organizations and politicians to, they feel pressure then to respond. And there is a kind of tyranny of the audience in this sense. So the response from the Times to this story was an immediate apology. Well, the next day, though, the editor-in-chief recanted that apology and said, wait a minute, we were too hasty. We got bullied here. The whole point of the story was to not normalize and condone the Nazi party, but to say, look at the paradox built into this with this everyday person who you wouldn't suspect at all to be an affiliate of this party. There they are. It's more deeply infiltrated than into the society than we would suppose. And that was the point of the story. The editor came out then, 48 hours later, after more reflection, which, again, the 24-hour news cycle doesn't allow policymakers, let alone editors of papers. And so those policymakers are feeling pressure to make decisions quicker than maybe they really should.
We are talking about our 24-hour culture. With me, David Dowling, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa. Bob Bosselman is also here, professor of apparel, events, and hospitality management at Iowa State University. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. How do you take part in this 24-hour culture? How has it affected your life? Or maybe you've rejected 24-hour culture. Let us know. You can ask questions. You can share your stories. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And even if we don't work the night shift, more and more of us are working in bits and pieces at various times a day, often at night. We've been talking about this 24-hour news cycle, that access to information 24 hours a day is really appealing to a lot of people. We have that ability to be connected all of the time. How is that affecting our lifestyles? Benjamin Honeycutt is a professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa. He has studied how that affects us. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
So let's talk about, David was just talking about all of this content, all of this information that's available 24 hours a day, and I want to dig into that a little bit. But first, let's start with work, because on our smartphones, our tablets, these devices that connect us to the world 24 hours a day, we have access to our work email. People can text us. We have the information about our specific field. How is that affecting how we work?
That we are all living above the store, the metaphor of we're on call 24/7. from a business just below us or in contact with our email and so forth. Yeah, we're working longer now than certainly we expected to work. The work work week, the work day, the work year has expanded. We're working about 5 weeks longer now than we did in the 1970s, and that figure gets larger and larger, about 1%.
5 weeks longer per
year? 5 weeks longer per year than we did. And that we're this nation is, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, our country has the longest work, more hours put in per year than any other nation, industrial nation, except South Korea.
So it might not be that we're taking that much less vacation time even than in the 1970s, but our work days are expanding.
Well, vacation is another dimension. About 40% of the workforce who are entitled to vacation days don't take them all. About 20-25% take none at all. So the weekend itself is beginning to be stressed, working longer during the week. Weekdays, as Shell Oil did a study about how people spent their leisure during the weekend. And for the most part, most of us, 55%, are struggling to catch up with the chores that we didn't have a chance to do during the weekday.
And when we say chores, are we talking about work at home? Or are we talking about work?
Both.
Laundry
as well as the things that have piled up on our desk. So the retirement is another casualty of this expanding work thing that is occupying more and more of our lives. Retirement, according to the New York Times, has turned into a brief rest stop for a lot of us. We return to work for a variety of reasons. So we expected retirement to, well, this whole thing is unexpected, is what we've talked before, Charity, about this. The 19th and 20th century, at least half of the 20th century, the expectation was that technology would free us. We'd have more time for our families, for ourselves, for our spiritual life, all of those things, we'd have ample opportunity because of technology. So this whole thing is unexpected. It's something that no one, or John Maynard Keynes, as I've said before, in 1930, the most famous economist of the 20th century, predicted by 1980 we would all in the industrial nations be working about 2 hours a day at most, and only for the very busy among us. So again, this was a very my whole scholarly life has been trying to understand why that expectation has petered out, and
right.
we no longer we think 10 hours a day is what generally we're working. So. The time crunch certainly comes from work expanding into more and more of our lives.
Is it the economy driving this, do you think?
There are a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
I think there's certainly an economic dimension to it. Our needs and wants have expanded. That's one of the first things that I saw when I wrote about this in the 1970s when I was in graduate school at Carolina. So consumerism is part of it. I think work also has been elevated in importance. Leisure has been degraded in importance. I'm a professor of leisure studies, and Roger Dangerfield says I don't get no respect, but I'm delighted with my study of time. Leisure was, for such a long time, for people like Walt Whitman and Emerson, it would be the time to realize the best of our humanity. Work was necessary, of course. But it wasn't the time that we would really blossom as human beings. We really find community, understanding, sharing, transcendence in the time outside of work and not the 24/7 cycle that we've got into. We've lost sight. Jacques Ellul, one of my favorite French theologians, says that we can't even imagine an alternative. That even the possibility of a life centered not in work but in free time is something we've completely lost sight of.
Well, so that also speaks to human behavior that is driving this as well. I mean, we must like this at some level because we are fully participating.
Well, or don't see an alternative.
Okay.
And here, your producer asked that maybe I could come up with some suggestions about how to get off of the treadmill, and that's quite a task. But I think one of the ways is to begin to look at the possibility of buying not material goods but experiences. Experiences take time. The new sciences of happiness that have developed over the recent or the last 20 years, positive psychology, positive neurobiology, all look at experiences as a vital part of happiness. When we spend money, they found research finding that when we spend money on experiences, we are much happier than when we spend money on material purchases. Material purchases are out there. They get old. They rust. Our neighbor gets something better. Experiences are in here. We remember them. We share them. A person that has an experience, a great experience, we're not jealous of that. We take delight in sharing experiences.
Well, we are going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about our 24/7 culture today. And with me, Benjamin Honeycutt, professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa. Bob Bosselman is here, professor of apparel, events, and hospitality management at Iowa State University. And David Dowling, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. How have you gotten off the treadmill? Tell us your story. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This week is Iowa Week, and all week long we're exploring Iowa after dark. This hour we're focusing on our 24/7 culture, a culture that continues to evolve, and we are all connected 24 hours a day if we choose to be. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the 24/7 culture, how you participate, what you like about it, maybe how you've tried to disconnect yourself from that culture. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Bob Bosselman, professor of apparel, events, and hospitality management at Iowa State University. David Dowling, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa. And Benjamin Honeycutt, professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa. And just before the break, Ben, you were talking about the importance of having experience. And we're also seeing a shift in the generation that's coming up right now, the millennial generation. They're the 20-somethings, early 30-somethings even now, that are part of the workforce. We're seeing a shift in values. What are we seeing reflected?
Eventbrite, one of the major players in rock concerts and that sort of thing, did a study, a survey not that long ago, that found the millennial generations prefer to buy experiences much more than they prefer to buy material or even, you know, property, own things or property or buy consumer goods. There's a shift in the millennial generation toward experiences that really does show up in a dramatic fashion in the empirical research that's been done.
That's fascinating. Well, and I think you can see it anecdotally with a real resurgence in live music culture.
Exactly.
And things like that. And Bob, I'm curious about what you're seeing in the hospitality industry. If millennials are looking for more experiences, how does that drive the kind of services that hospitality services are offering?
They're certainly more adventurous with respect to travel. They don't hesitate to pick up and go someplace. I think that's very different from prior generations. Obviously, we would like to see people travel more and, you know, stay in hotels and resorts. And I certainly would agree with Dr. Honeycutt in the sense that we, the older generations, we've sacrificed vacations for work, and we haven't traveled as much as we should. I think that still today only about 25% of the population has a passport. But a lot of young people are traveling. It has a lot to do with the fact that they did study abroad either in high school or college, and they're very open to going just about anywhere, which is which is good for the good for our business. And the other change is a lot of travel today is very short, 2 and 3 day, versus we think of people taking week-long vacations, and that's not the norm.
That's very interesting. And Ben, I know you've done quite a bit of research about what we need when we unplug and take vacation. And your research has not indicated that we should take 2 or 3 days off at a time, right?
Well, again, following the millennial generation into this new experience economy, Airbnb is, as you know, a major player mm-hmm. now in hotels and so forth, where you person to person through the internet, you find a place and roam from an individual that a stranger to stranger that's mediated by Airbnb. They have come up with a new line of product experiences. So that you can, if you're in Rome, for example, you can sign up for $60 a night and go visit this little town just outside of Rome to Grandma's Kitchen. And you get, with a group of others, 5 or 6 others, you get to spend the afternoon with Grandma and her nieces making pasta, drinking wine, their wine, and seeing the culture from the ground up. A great experience, that sort of person-to-person thing that's facilitated by the internet is I think, where the travel industry is going.
That's
it looks like it.
So much creativity right now. I want to get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I hate conclusions, but that's what I've got the time for. And I think the issue, one of the issues, is that the speed of communication has simply surpassed the ability of the majority of people to process the information intelligently and respond intelligently. And I think we end up with things like bad reporting. It's not fake news. It's I apologize, but I just call it stupid news. We don't know enough yet, but we've rushed to get the information that we've come up with into the mix, and the result is, I think, as I say, terrible writing, terrible communication skills, and the whole thing just perpetuates itself.
Well, it's an interesting thought, David. Thank you so much for calling, and I'm going to turn to another David, David Dowling, to respond to that. Now, we did talk about how there's a divide. We're seeing some in-depth content being created. There's sort of a renaissance in that, new creativity going into that. But the other David is right, too. I mean, we are seeing this speed of communication, this urge to be the first, statements being said without attribution, without fact-checking, right?
Right. Well, we know that the Boston bomber, for example, you know, the Boston Marathon bombing, the person who perpetrated that crime was totally misidentified, and it was mainly due to social media. You know, people attached to their phones 24/7, and you know, very much obviously expressing their anxiety about this event, but channeling that energy in completely the wrong ways. You know, to try to, you know, do their own sort of police investigation. So we do have on one hand citizen journalism coming in and really making this sort of a post-scoop era. You know, people are going to bring their own raw video out and post it. They're going to have their own sort of take on the crime scene, as it were, but they might be wrong, you know, it might terribly go awry. And a lot of news organizations pick up on that.
And it might be amplified to the point where everybody believes what is wrong.
Exactly. And hence we get so much really, you know, wrong news, you know, not just disinformation, but it's just flat out wrong. And not fact-checked.
Right. Yeah. And then the sharing of purposely false news,
right,
it feeds into that opportunity. I mean, it's a very opportunistic thing. Because we have that amplification process, that's where these people who are preying on our public have been able to take advantage of it.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, too, to think about the 24-hour news cycle and how much pressure that puts on democracy as we know it. Not to get too general here, but, you know, the caller said, okay, news quality seems to be washing out. It seems to be getting more and more shallow. And on some levels, that's true. On other levels, though, when we look at something like the Washington Post, you know, which is Jeff Bezos owned, et cetera, you know, a lot of people will say, well, you know, there's the, you know, more big tech money coming over and just basically eating the internet, taking over the world. But in fact, you know, stories are now longer than ever in well, not quite than ever, but about 30% longer than they have been in, say, the last decade at the Washington Post since he took over. The journalism is becoming journalism of advocacy there. It's becoming much more aggressive. I would argue there's good news on that front. You can find bright spots. It's easy to generalize. I mean, this show, for example, right? You know, we need to see where things are going well. But I think just in general, though, the 24-hour news cycle is putting a lot of pressure on policymakers to set agendas quickly, more quickly than they really should in some cases, and to not think it through. In other cases, though, the 24-hour news cycle is terrific for humanitarian aid. You know, we just had a massive disaster, obviously, in Indonesia, correct? And aid has now traveled there faster than ever before. You know, so this can be a good thing. And of course, we know that you know, people want to help, and when they do have anxiety over the news, they can help now faster than ever, thanks to our technology.
And I'm hearing echoes of what Ben was saying earlier about how we have to take responsibility for our connectedness. So we have to decide, you know, to self-care, unplug, take that leisure time if we need it. But we also are in control of how we consume information, and we have to be our own advocates as far as finding news sources we can trust.
I agree. Again, news is not my area of expertise. Right. Experiences are, but to find alternatives, your show, A Taste of Iowa, one of my favorites. You're spending time having experiences with all these wonderful people, and we just went up to Cater over the weekend to a farm from my hippie days that has turned into a CSA and new couple there, and wonderful. They've built a community, a new community around the from stalwarts, probably Trump supporters among the group that we were in, but who cares? It was a community. You experience that, and you see an alternative to the 24/7. You see something that's attractive, something I'd like to continue to do, give me another reason to retire, to have more time for that. And I think that's where it's going to come from, the desire for more time. First, through these experiences that are so enriching and that alternative, we find time and the desire will follow.
Let's get back to the phones, 866-780-9100. AJ is on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, AJ.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a question for Dr. Honeycutt. He talked about how we're working long hours in America, and so many industrial countries are far ahead of us when it comes to vacation time and holidays. And also, even when we talk about leisure as a field of study, so many people have a very negative view of the word leisure. They, you know, it brings to mind for them laziness or being wasteful with time. And so I prefer to say free time. And I'm wondering if Dr. Honeycutt has any thoughts about other countries. They're working, you know, 30, 35-hour weeks instead of 40 hours and more a week. If job sharing and those kinds of things will come, you know, into prominence, and if we can possibly look forward to seeing Americans get to a 30 to 35-hour work week so that we had more free time.
Oh, that was a deep sigh, Ben. What do you say?
I don't think that Europe is going to be a greatly attractive model to us, but it is, you're right, the caller is right, that other industrial nations have 2 to 3 times many days. We have about 10, and the average in Europe, I think, is 25 or so. So we are way behind in terms of vacation days, in terms of hours, in terms of the understanding of alternatives to work. The Scandinavian countries are playing with the 30-hour week. Stockholm has the tradesmen in Stockholm. They're really seeing this as an alternative, a way of improving their economy. They count leisure time in as part of the benefit of the economy, instead of doing gross national product or that sort of thing, they count in free time as a positive part of what the economy is producing. So Norway and the cheese manufacturers in Norway are trying a 30-hour week as an alternative to unemployment. Unemployment, we're finding boom times now with employment great, but over the long term, the unemployment is chronic. So short hours has been put forward as a way to deal with that, but also to enrich the lives of the people in those countries.
Before we run out of time, I want to get one more caller in. Patrick's on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. I'm wanting to mention a unique opportunity for students that's been brought about at the University of Iowa by David Gould and the community, where every Monday night, people in Iowa City can go to the Englert Theater, at least over the next four or five Mondays now, and it started two Mondays ago, and see students very, very creatively putting together ideas involved with their passion as in terms of reaching out, providing interesting and meaningful ideas for engaged social innovation to the community. He calls it the green room, and these students are all getting a better sense of themselves, the idea of giving back, forming communities, and actually interacting with Iowa City, where people have a chance to see these great speakers that typically accompany the activity. And it's a very live, real way of seeing news being made, so to speak, and communities being formed in real time. And it's a fantastic opportunity to talk about what makes people really happy. And it's the idea of forming communities, giving back, participating in a manner where you have a rudder versus being just caught up in the tide of materialism
Thank you so much for mentioning that. We've done a couple of programs about the Green Room on Talk of Iowa in the past, and we're nearly out of time, but Ben, I'll let you have a word here about that. We are seeing more opportunities for people to talk about meaning. Again, we were talking about this sort of shift in the millennial culture where people are developing different priorities. It's also a privilege to be in a position to develop those priorities as well. So we're seeing that as something that our privileged classes have an opportunity to do. Is it something that people of other classes can also participate in?
I think so. I think there's an equality in leisure. We all have 24 hours. So we all have the possibility of developing skills to fill that time. It's a democratic possibility. And the communities that form, I know David Gould very well. He was a former student of mine, and he's a brilliant man. The Green Room is really a great thing. So that experimental attitude, trying to find ways, venues, either through public sector or in the private world of selling goods and services, the farms that turn into agricultural tourism, that sort of thing, trying to bring people together in ways that do form community. I think we see that happening across the state.
Well, Ben Honeycutt, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome, Jared.
Ben Honeycutt, professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa. David, one of my big takeaways is that we have to take personal responsibility, not just for our work lives, our leisure time, but how we interact with this technology as well. Is that one of your main takeaways, too?
Yeah, definitely. To be mindful with how you interact with it is important. And obviously to not just sort of get into a mindless rhythm in terms of what you consume and how easily distracted you are, but to be very selective about what it is.
David,
you engage.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks.
David Dowling, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa. Bob Bosselman, professor of apparel, events, and hospitality management at Iowa State. Thank you for being here today.
It was a pleasure to be with you, Charity.
Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Iowa Week continues through Friday. I'm Charity Nebbe. Through some hoops, wanna get my body loose.